And of course, our special guest tonight, Malcolm Nance, author of Defeating ISIS. We're going to be back and talk more with them. Plus, we'll take limited calls this hour from you right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Malcolm Nance with us, his book, Defeating ISIS. Malcolm, we've all seen pictures of ISIS members in brand new Humvees, new tennis shoes, brandishing assault weapons. Where do they get all that stuff?
Well, they get it the traditional way that all insurgent groups get their weapons and equipment. They capture them. ISIS is a very understood from their, years. Like I said, between 2003 and, 2014, 2011, they fought the United States. They had a logistics pipeline coming out of Syria, the very country that they would later help collapse and take all the weapons and equipment that they needed from the government of Syria. And then when they did their offenses in Iraq, they just simply took the weapons and equipment that they captured from the Iraqi army. They took 3 divisions worth of weapons and equipment, enough weapons for 40,000 men. We know from the logistics stockpiles, they captured 60,000 M16 rifles. They captured over 1,000 Humvees. But, if there's any solace in that, they can't maintain these Humvees.
And they'll run out of ammunition eventually. Right?
Well, they have enough ammunition to fight on the level that they're fighting at. It's their logistics pipeline is completely done up by the Toyota Land Cruiser pickup truck. That's the official weapon of ISIS. But Humvees, for example, which everybody is concerned about, they don't drive those around. They've converted almost all of them into suicide bomb trucks. We call them bomb Vs. They put steel plate across the front and across the windows and side and wheels, and they drive at high speed into a base because the suicide truck bomb is now their principal assault.
You really can't stop it if it's that well protected.
Yeah, I've seen video of 50 caliber machine guns just wailing away on a Humvee with steel plate. That's a suicide truck bomb. It did not stop the vehicle. The vehicle breached the perimeter and then blew up. And it's always followed by a second or a third assault vehicle, then their infantry assaults. So ISIS, and we have an entire analysis of ISIS's ground combat capability, their strategy. We had a Delta Force operator go over how they fight on the street. And it's just fascinating that they do this hybrid warfare where they're half insurgent, half terrorist. It's fascinating.
In terms of what ISIS has been up to, you have to feed them. You have to house them. Where are they sleeping?
Well, it's very simple. They've captured an enormous part of Iraq. Mosul is the second largest city in Iraq and had a population of 2 million people. And all of the cities in northwestern Iraq, western Iraq, including Fallujah and Ramadi, which we've now retaken, they're the third largest city in Syria, Raqqa, in northeastern Syria, is their headquarters. So they take from the population whatever they want, but they established a very deep trading relationship with the mafias of Turkey. And they were getting food brought across the border in exchange for straight enormous quantities of cash, oil that they were pumping out of the ground, out of Syrian and Iraqi oil fields. Ironically, I had a security contract in northern Iraq for the Nejm oil field, and it is now the largest producing oil field for ISIS. It got taken when they seized Mosul. So all of these activities are where they get their money from. But they also get their money from slave trade. They get their money from seizing the central bank in Mosul. And then again, there's external ways that they make money through the internet and through the sale of illicit artifacts. They create blood artifacts that they sell to Westerners in the open market. We've even seen some on eBay.
Jeez. Yes. They've raided places. They've pillaged places. Now, can we beat them? Can we truly get rid of them? Or are there too many?
Well, yes, we can get rid of them. However, you have to understand, ISIS, like Al-Qaeda in Iraq before it, its father organization, is you have to view this group as a ball of mercury. Place pressure down on a ball of mercury, what happens? Breaks up, spreads out, goes into 100 other small rolling balls of mercury, all of which are very difficult to get back together. Take that pressure off, they all roll back together and congeal. That is the fundamental strategy that, as far back as Sun Tzu, you know, the great Chinese war philosopher, had said about, you know, avoiding a battle. And ISIS is being bombed right now. They're being contained. We've destroyed, we've killed as many as 23,000 of their fighters, and we're starting to see those effects.
What's the demographics, Malcolm, of that? Yeah. How old are these young men, mostly?
Well, now since, you know, since the call to their jihad in 2013, 2014, a large demographic has been, it's been very wide. I mean, it's pulled in people from the entirety of the world, not just the Middle East, the world, have heeded this call to come to what they believe is their only correct version of their Islamic world, which is why they call themselves the Islamic State, and to come to their caliphate, which only involves where they're fighting in order to go out and you know, to rape and pillage. So they get a lot of young men. They get a lot of young Americans and Europeans, all of whom think that not only are they coming to be good Muslims, which the average Muslim on the street will tell you, no, you're not. You're almost, you know, worshiping Iblis, as they say in Arabic, Satan, demons. But that they can come and on day one become special forces, right? And they get their choice of the women. They get their choice of a house. They get a life. And they get things that they wouldn't have had in their, you know, technically loser lives back overseas. So, you know, that's pretty much the composition of that group. But at the same time, they have a captive population of 5 million people, all of whom are prisoners and who have to work essentially for them.
Malcolm, as you look at where we're headed with this situation in terms of this election that's coming up, are any of these candidates qualified to deal with this? None of them has military training or experience. They didn't do what you've done. They didn't even do what I did. I mean, how could they be commanders-in-chief and guide our military to victory over these thugs?
Well, fortunately, the role of commander-in-chief has always been in the hands of a civilian.
Yes.
Even General George Washington relinquished being a general and avoided being a dictator.
But he was a general, and Eisenhower was a general. They had military experience.
That's true. But then again, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, we didn't have Eisenhower to guide Vietnam, and we don't have Washington today. However, the military is very proficient. The Joint Chiefs on down were very good at war fighting, which, if called upon to do it, will do it. However, we also learn lessons. We know that ISIS is part of their radical ideology. And I want to touch on this. ISIS is fighting to bring back, to force the hand of God. They're fighting to return their version of their savior, the Mahdi,
That's right.
back to earth. And the Mahdi has to fight an army from Rome in a battle of Dabiq, which is in northern Syria, which is why they're fighting there. And he will bring about the return of the Antichrist. And when the Antichrist comes, the prophet Jesus, son of Miriam, which is the same as our Jesus, will return, defeat the Antichrist, and then Judgment Day will come.
Truly the apocalypse, isn't it?
It is the apocalypse. They are fighting for their version of the Book of Revelation. They are forcing it. They want gods to respond to their actions. So think of that. We are fighting a battle against an apocalyptic Islamic cult. And not the first time it's popped up in Islam. It's popped up four other times. So they want us to come. The proper military thing to do is not to be on the battlefield, but to use other forces, surrogate forces.
Yeah.
And as one part of my last chapter, how to defeat them, one of the things we need to do is we need to go back to an old school special operations strategy, almost World War II, of, you know, the OSS and the Jedburghs, where we need to marry up with our allies, but in 100, 200-man units, jump or helicopter into ISIS's rear, tear up their lines of communication, and force them to come out of these cities. Because ISIS's caliphate is just a series of cities connected by highways. You cut those highways, they're isolated little islands of ISIS. And it would change the entire narrative of the war overnight if every 24 hours we were carrying out 5 or 10 of these long, large-scale raids where our Arab allies were landing in ISIS's rear, challenging them to come out and destroying them with air power, then jumping back on the airplanes or helicopters and disappearing.
I've always wondered when we saw video of ISIS in their Toyota trucks and Humvees on this miles and miles of snake-looking road, waving and cheering, why nobody bombed them. I couldn't understand that, Malcolm.
Yeah, those, we call them Toyota Task Forces, TTFs. They would pop up for video purposes. They have a dedicated news media machine in there that's fabulous. And they would bring these groups together for very short durations. You can't tell a civilian Toyota from a military Toyota unless it has a gun in it. Over the last year and a half, we have obliterated any truck that has a gun in it. So now what they do is they throw them in dump trucks, or they throw them in the back of large-scale, you know, tractor trailers with the roofs cut off and then a tarp over the top. And we can't see inside there. And then they whip the tarp off and the gun is exposed. So they've taken to masking virtually everything. But then again, ISIS are the masters of using just about anything they have. Most of their suicide bomb assaults now are led by a Caterpillar tractor that has armored sheeting all over it that uses its lift, you know, its scooper, front loader, to tear holes in trenches and berms and then rolls in and blows up. So we're just getting proficient at destroying those. But we have destroyed a lot of their equipment, virtually all of their tanks. And now they're reduced to bringing children onto the battlefield and creating a
pathetic
women's unit now, if you can believe that.
There was a woman suicide bomber today in the Middle East.
I think that was Boko Haram, in which is the African ISIS. And they've had over 90 women suicide bombers. And what they do is they gang rape these women in captivity. And then they say, well, the only way you can reconcile yourself with God is to commit an act of jihad.
Well, and dying is probably better for them in their minds than going through what they've been going through.
Absolutely.
Jeez.
And yeah, sexual assault, sexual slavery, pedophilia, completely religiously sanctioned in ISIS. Whereas in Islam, it's a death sentence. So, you know, ISIS is a cult. The way Jim Jones was a Christian cult, ISIS is a religious, an Islamic cult. And you should only see them in those terms. It will clarify everything. And I have two whole chapters in how they meet the entire cult checklist, like the Manson, and controlling people through behavior, emotional thought, and information control.
How has Putin done handling the situation?
Oh, all fluff and mirrors. Everybody says that, you know, Putin's strongman flies his forces in. Putin's forces did not attack ISIS. Putin's forces came in for Assad and attacked the U.S. and Saudi-backed insurgents, the Free Syrian Army, in order to try to take the city of Aleppo. Less than 10% of attacks that were carried out by the Russian Air Force were carried out on any ISIS positions, and they did attack oil tankers that were going to Turkey, mainly to punish Turkey for shooting down one of their fighter planes.
Right.
Believe me, now that Russia is withdrawing some equipment from there, compared to what the United States has done in the last year and a half, Putin's airstrikes were flashy. They didn't use any smart weapons whatsoever. They just, what we call dumb bombs, you know, they fly over a target and they drop them.
He gets a lot of public relations out of this.
But it's all video. It's all media. Whereas the United States, we have quietly decimated this organization. They can't operate during the daytime. They can't go into any of their governmental buildings. We've literally assassinated virtually all of their senior leadership.
And we should do more.
Well, there's, you know, the only thing you can do at this point is special operations mission. You cannot put a U.S. Army on the ground there. But what we can do is encourage our Arab allies, who have over 2 million men combined, perhaps to carry out what we call a humanitarian intervention of Syria, to isolate Assad off to the west and to isolate ISIS off to the east and wedge ISIS between, a pan-Arab army or special operations force and the Iraqi army, which is now on the march and has learned to finally fight ISIS and beat them.
Let's take a few calls here for you, Malcolm. Then we'll wrap up in our final half hour with the rest of the calls as they line up here for you. Jeff in Massachusetts on the wild card line. Hey, Jeff, go ahead.
Oh, thank you very much.
Sure thing.
As far as Islam is concerned, in order to defeat ISIS, the mosques in this country have to be closed, starting off with the Boston Islamic Center in Roxbury, Massachusetts. And I'll tell you why. I believe these mosques are going to be ammo depots for a future Islamic conflict in this country. I believe the targets will be soft areas like Boston, New York, and Washington, D.C., and other soft liberal targets. Anywhere where there's a mosque, Islamic conflict will soon follow. Look at the election of Relio Odinga, 2007 to 2008. His supporters went on a jihad when he didn't get in. Tell me what you think of that. I'll listen off air.
All right, Jeff, thank you. What do you think of that, Malcolm? I mean, is that being a little too unrealistic?
Yeah. Okay, I'm gonna put my intelligence, U.S. intelligence officer's hat on. I've lived in the Middle East for 35 years. I've operated in there 35 years. I just returned from 7 years.
God, what rank did you achieve, by the way?
I was senior enlisted. I was a senior chief petty officer in the Navy, and then after that, I became a U.S., a contract intelligence officer.
I made it to lieutenant.
Oh, well, just remember, all of SEAL Team 6 are chiefs.
You got that right.
And
I have no qualms about that from me, believe you.
You know, there's technical expertise. So I've put my little intelligence officer's hat on now. The Muslim world is not the risk here. Mosques in the United States are not ammunition dumps. The terrorists who will come to the United States will not go near a mosque. People have this impression back in the 1990s, there was a mosque in England called the Brixton Mosque, which did act as sort of a terrorist, operations center. But after a while, British intelligence got information about that. That place was quickly cleared out. And it was the mosque practitioners, all of the rest of the community, that started turning in the Muslims. If there are terrorists going to mosque in the United States, they are essentially talking to the FBI.
Yes, targets too.
Yes. The Muslim community in the United States and the Muslim world are peaceful people. I will tell you what the Muslim world wants right now. A 2015 Toyota Corolla, and they want their kids to go to a good school. That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
If they could get a visa to the United States, they would do that too. But most people in the world want what we want.
They want peace. They want to raise their families.
Yeah. But ISIS? Completely different animal. If they have literally written that if they could go to Saudi Arabia, they would kill everyone in all of Saudi leadership. They would destroy all shrines in Saudi Arabia, including the shrine of the Prophet Muhammad in Medina, because they believe that any structure other than a basic mosque, anything with art in it, is worshiping something other than God.
Malcolm, we're going to come back and take final calls with you. Wonderful job, by the way, defeating ISIS. We'll be back. Welcome back to Coast, Malcolm Nance with us. Malcolm, I guess I should ask you, where do we get your book, Defeating ISIS?
Well, you can get Defeating ISIS in any major bookstore and Amazon.com. I think it's running pretty cheap there, about $18. And if you do, leave a positive review.
Amazon does a great job, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Of course, sort of the bookstores. I hate seeing some bookstores go, but the small ones, the ma-and-pa stores, are still out there. They're the backbone of communities, and I hope they keep going. Now, back with ISIS for a second, then we'll wrap things up with final calls here for you.
Sure.
At any given time, how many of them have accumulated together to do whatever they do in terms of trying to destroy areas? I mean, a 500, 1,000, how many?
That's the beauty of an insurgent terrorist group, or as we call it, an expeditionary terrorist group. It could be five men. You can destabilize any area. But what they do is they send out these cells of trained professionals, and they go into areas where there's chaos. They establish logistics pipelines. They make relationship with mafias. Like in Libya, they started relationships with the migrant mafias that were sending people over to Europe. They took control of areas and then started getting funds from sending migrants from Libya into Italy. And then they establish, they take over a town. So it could be anywhere from, you know, start off with five, end up with 500. People will flow in that can't get to Iraq and Syria. They'll come into Egypt. They'll come into Libya. They'll come into Tunisia. And then once they get a critical mass, of course, they collect their weapons equipment, and then they seize a city or an area, and they hold it.
Where is the brain command for ISIS?
Still in Raqqa, Syria, with the senior commanders who we haven't killed, starting with their caliph, as he calls himself, self-styled caliph, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. But we just killed the number one man in Syria. We hit him with a drone strike, and we are quickly working our way through all of their most talented commanders. But now they're popping up in Egypt, where the Egyptian army is in full-scale war with them in the Sinai Peninsula. They're popping up in Libya, where now we have two halves of Libya are coming together to fight them along with European special forces. Boko Haram in Nigeria, that war's been going on for almost 10 years.
Yeah.
But we have three nations surrounding them, trying to wipe them out and stop their murderous rampage. The Shabab, in which was an al-Qaeda-backed group in Somalia, has now declared, part of that group has declared their allegiance to ISIS.
We just bombed them last week, didn't we?
We did, and as a matter of fact, it's a good example of ISIS's penchant for coming together like a military force. Did not work out well there. We found 150 of them. And believe me, we can count. We have the systems to count when we've killed a man. We can see them before, after, and during. So, you know, you get an AC-130 gunship up there with drones and other strike aircraft, you can pretty much rest assured that we got 150 of them.
One of the concerns, of course, Malcolm, is retaliation back here, back in the United States.
Yes.
Is that possible?
It's possible because ISIS is not like al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, it took years to groom an operative. They'd bring him to Afghanistan. They would train him. They would try to reinfiltrate him back into his nation state. ISIS is a concept, a far extreme version of al-Qaeda's ideology, and any person with a mental defect can join the group, swear an allegiance, take a rifle, go to a mall, shoot people, and say that they did it in the name of ISIS. The largest shooting in Canada was carried out by a Catholic who had converted over to ISIS's version of Islam, not real Islam, and then walked into, you know, Canada's parliament and started shooting people. So this can happen anywhere, and this is why we have to go after the ideology. And the best way to go after the ideology is to support the Muslim world, who we have been fighting in defense of since 9/11, to crush them, because that's 1.6 billion people versus approximately 100,000.
You know, and I know, as you probably do, Malcolm, I know many Muslims here in the United States who are hardworking professionals, dedicated, they've got families. This stuff appalls them, what's going on right now.
Sure. And, you know, people ask me all the time, well, we're going to bring in 10,000 Syrian families. You know, what can we do with them? They're going to be terrorists. No. How about 10,000 new employees for the FBI and CIA's foreign language offices? We don't have enough people who have lived through these experiences, who know who these terrorists are, who can do wiretaps, who can do court transcripts, who can translate for Voice of America. We need as many of those people as possible. Not a million, no single men. We're not taking in single men. We're bringing in families. And if we hadn't brought in families from Syria in the late 1800s, there would be no, you know, the Pennsylvania Lebanese Syrian community wouldn't exist. We wouldn't have Marlo Thomas and Danny Thomas. So, you know, immigrant waves into the United States are nothing new, and they do bring assets.
Let's take a few more calls now. Joe in the Bronx. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good.
I'd like to ask Malcolm Nance. Now, recently, as you alluded to earlier, the Russians have ceased their bombing certain areas in Syria. But John Kerry has gone to meet with Putin and other Russian officials, I assume discussing the situation in Syria. Now, can we appease the Russians in a way by having only limited dealings with Assad and at the same time trying to fight ISIS? And also, how can we curtail the global jihad?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. Can you appease the Russians? Well, right now Russia is Putin is feeling frisky. He is in a breakout mode to where he has decided he wanted to reestablish some of the dominance of Russia that they had in his last years when he was director of the KGB in the former Soviet Union. I'm a board member of the International Spy Committee and International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. And one of the other board members is Oleg Kalugin, former director of the KGB, one of Putin's former bosses. And, you know, he and many people believe that Russia is now trying to reestablish this dominance in a world that they no longer have dominance. Oil prices have practically collapsed. They have sanctions in some areas. They are not, you know, BMW and Mercedes sales have plummeted in Russia. And Putin is now being adventurous outside of there, which is why he took Crimea, is fighting the Ukraine in the secret war, and now thought he would help his only last Arab client state in the Middle East, Assad, try to fight Western-backed forces and not ISIS. If ISIS breaks out from this, and when they're on the defensive, they attack. They don't wait around to see if we're going to, you know, defeat them. They could literally try to blitz Damascus and try to put an end to this thing. Given the proper resources. And Russia will not, you know, be able to do much to help them.
Where is the tinderbox, the most important place for ISIS right now, Malcolm?
Well, they are everywhere right now, to be quite honest. And they are establishing, using that pattern of infiltrating agents, getting weapons, breaking out and carrying out attacks against police, just about everywhere. They're going up against all of Europe's overseas hotels in order to damage tourism in any country that has any relationships with the West. And they're being successful. Five or six men can literally destroy a country's, tourism industry.
Oh, sure.
In Algeria.
Absolutely.
So their next mission is, as you said a little earlier, they want to punish the United States. They want the United States to act rashly. They want to incite hatred of the Muslim world. And some of the rhetoric that's coming from the campaign trail, you asked that question earlier, is not helping. We have literally special forces soldiers and U.S. intelligence officers elbow to elbow with members of our Muslim allies fighting in defense of their nations. So trying to keep Muslims out of the United States or claim that all of Islam represents ISIS hurts us immensely.
I agree.
And we have paid in blood of our soldiers in the Muslim world. We have to root out this virus, and we need to do it quickly, because if it infects the rest of the Muslim world, then you're really going to have a fight.
Social media, has it helped ISIS?
Yeah, they dominate social media because, as a matter of fact, I wrote in my book an entire chapter on how they do social media. We do not attack their Islam. We don't attack their version of Islam. What you hear is you hear these attacks on Muslims, and that doesn't help, so the Muslim world turns off. We have to go after their cultism. And the Muslim world would love to have that called out. I was just at a forum at Princeton a few weeks ago, and we had a brilliant Muslim wife of an imam who was speaking on behalf of Muslim women. And when I started saying, hey, the Muslim world is speaking out, and I passed it on to her, and she said, no, you keep it up. Nobody listens to me. You know, we have to listen to the other 1.6 billion people and help facilitate their voice into the rejection of this cultism. Because as I said before, it's happened four times before in Islam, and it's been stamped out quickly once the Muslim world is engaged. And so that's the best that we can do.
Let's go to Bernard on our international line in Vancouver, Canada. Hello, Bernard. Thank you.
Yes, hello. If I may presume to address your guest by his first name.
Malcolm, it is.
Yeah, sure. Malcolm, I'd like to commend you for your refreshing forthrightness in your assessment regarding the reasons for attacking or not attacking the Gaddafi regime in Libya. Some of us have been very concerned about our Canadian government, particularly under the Harper regime, and all the members of the different parties in Parliament and the media seem to have no clue. And the reasons for France going in, we saw recently, that had nothing to do with anything morally justifiable. It seemed to have all to do with money and gold and prestige of currency. And I just wish that we could hear a little bit of this more often, especially somebody with your experience in military intelligence.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. I really appreciate your comments. You know, I liked Canada when Canada was the heart of acting as the NATO's sort of overseas trainers, and not taking a more forward role like Trudeau wants to do now. However, we need Canada as a central organization. We need Canada as what they're doing in northern Iraq, which is training and facilitating the Kurdish forces. But then again, we also need somebody who can temper the NATO allies into understanding that there are greater roles that even small countries like Canada can provide.
Malcolm, Saudi Arabia, how concerned are they about ISIS? I mean, is the regime of the kingdom, are they concerned?
Yes, absolutely. They view ISIS as an existential threat to the kingdom. The Grand Mufti of Islam, of Saudi Arabia, 1.5 years ago, declared ISIS the number one enemy of Islam. That's pretty severe. The only thing about the Saudis is they are very peculiar in their use of words. They believe that ISIS can be brought back. You know, that corrupted members of ISIS, and any Muslim, can always be brought back.
I'm not sure of that.
Education. Yeah. And, you know, they are irreconcilable. That group is going to have to be destroyed to the man. And they are going to have to, show that corruption of Islam. And the Saudis are very reticent in making that faith-based decision of determining whether someone is still a Muslim or not. They believe only God can do that. But they are fighting. They are more than willing now. We just recently heard from the Saudis that they were going to carry out one of the predictions I made in the book, that they were more than willing to carry out an invasion of Syria with their other Arab allies in order to stop ISIS and get rid of the Assad regime. Now, whether that happens will be very interesting to see whether that actually is carried out.
Where does Iran fit into all of this?
Iran is a Shia nation, which is only 15% of the Muslims in the world, and they are posed as the regional opposition to Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. They're very big. You have to remember the United States supported Iran from 1952 to 1979. It was a little United States kingdom, bastion and ally with the Shah of Iran. Saudi Arabia views them as sort of like the way we viewed the Soviet Union in the Cold War, as an opponent that has to be dealt with. You can't go to war with them, but you can stop their mischief because Iran is arming Houthi forces, which are Shias, along Saudi's southern border in Yemen, which has led to the complete destabilization of Yemen, which has allowed ISIS and al-Qaeda to flourish with no controls. They are in southern Lebanon and are fighting with the Assad government, which is why the Saudis believe that Sunni Syria, which is 65% of the country, are Sunni Muslims like the Saudis. Saudi Arabia would rather cleanse that country of Assad and then take on the fight of ISIS at a later date. But the United States wants to fight ISIS first. So these geopolitical axes there are very important, to the point that Saudi Arabia and Israel secretly cooperate and talk to each other because they all see who the threat really is.
Let's go to Rosemary in Ontario, Canada. First-time caller for us. Hi, Rosemary.
Hi there. Such a pleasure to be able to speak to you. I'm 90 years old.
Well, good for you.
Wow.
God love you.
The eyebrows up. But I wanted to, first of all, just tell you how much I have enjoyed you over the years. I've listened to you for ages. I've tried to reach you, and I just can't believe I'm actually talking to you.
You have. We only have a few minutes for you, Rosemary, before the clock gets us, but go ahead.
I just want you to know how greatly I admire you, and thank you for all of your bringing information to us. And I want to thank Malcolm for being so erudite. I'm sorry that I'm not as articulate as I used to be, but I'm a military family. I went to university in Indiana, and I wrote Jackie Cochran, who was the head of the WASPs at the time, and she accepted me, except I had to know how to fly. So I wrote my father in Canada, and I asked him if he trying to get me some money so that I could learn to fly and join the Wasps. But he was furious, and anyway, I didn't. I ended up by joining the Ferry Command in Montreal. I wanted to talk to you about so many things. I'm way overwhelmed. I've forgotten most of them. I wanted to say that my brother was a general. He, my father was a war ace in the First World War, and my brother was in Spitfirepolitan the Second. And he worked his way up to become a general later on.
That's fantastic.
Et cetera. But he was so unimpressed with the politics of the what controlled the, our military. He had to fight tooth and nail to try and stop some of the stupid things that the politicians were trying to do, you know, because they really, truly don't know anything about the military. We have, as our Minister of Defense at the moment, we have a new government, by the way, and they have appointed a Sikh colonel as their head of defense. But, you know, I think my brother was rolling in his grave because I'm not disparaging the knowledge as a colonel has, but they don't have the military savvy of...
And they need to understand that. Rosemary, we're out of time. You ought to call us on in open line night. I'd love to talk with you further. And Malcolm, as for you, thank you so much for being on the program. Great job on the book, Defeating ISIS. Malcolm Nance, we shall be back in a moment as we talk about the cabal of families that kind of put the United States together.